Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. And in this episode, I'll discuss cybersecurity matters in rural America with New York State Trooper Senior Investigator Ted Leveson. So to start, I want to thank everyone who's been downloading and listening to the podcast. It's available on the majority of the podcast providers out there, Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, things like that. So feel free to keep downloading from there. Tell your friends if there's something that you think would be of interest to them to download, take a listen, feel free to send me criticism or notes on how you think I'm doing, any topics you'd like to hear in the future, or if you have any questions, and I'll have some information on how to contact me at the end of the podcast. So again, thank you very much for listening. So the genesis for this episode was formed this weekend when I traveled to my hometown of Norwood, New York, to visit my mother. Now, Norwood is located in the largest and most rural area of New York State, St. Lawrence County, which is in the upper northwest corner of New York, right there on the Canadian border, above the Great Lakes. It's above Syracuse. It's above Buffalo. I would often, growing up, whenever I go anywhere outside of that area of the country and people say, where are you from? I say, New York. And they say, what part? I say, upstate. They usually say, where? Oh, Buffalo? No, not Buffalo. It is way north of that. Yeah, if you go any farther north, you're standing in Canada. So it's a very, very, very remote area of New York. The total population of the county is only about 100,000 people, but it's the third largest county this side of the Mississippi River. So it's a pretty big area, but not a lot of people live there. And as such, cybercrime has a much more pronounced impact due to the limited law enforcement resources that are located there. This doesn't mean this is the stuff that I'm going to talk about with Ted are only a rural problem. It's a problem for everybody, but the problem is amplified because it's hard for people to find the right law enforcement resources that they need to get the justice or to get their money back or things of that nature. We'll discuss all of that with investigator Ted Leveson in just a moment. And I should mention that Ted and I are related. We're cousins growing up. And so it was easy for me to reach out to him and say, hey, Ted, I'm coming up. Would you be interested in talking on my podcast about the cybercrime issues that you see up there? And he was more than happy to do so. So we'll talk to him about some of these issues and how the state troopers, who are the main law enforcement entity in upstate New York, how they deal with these kind of things. First, a couple news items just for your awareness. I saw an article this morning about small and medium businesses and how they're dealing with cybersecurity or how they're paying for it. It was a survey that was conducted by Untangle's third annual SMB IT security report. They did a survey of 500 small and medium-sized businesses. And the thing I thought was interesting is that 75% of these companies reported that their entire IT security budget is $10,000 or less, with 40% of those saying their IT security budget was $1,000 or less. So the question comes, what are you spending that money on, and how can you actually provide adequate cybersecurity or IT security, for that matter, with that amount of budget? And you really can't. You can buy some firewalls, maybe some antivirus, but you're not probably paying for multi-factor authentication for your employees. You're probably certainly not providing education. And so it becomes a huge problem because now you've got a lot of these companies that are dealing with remote workforces. And so they've increased their attack surface. In other words, they've increased the number of devices that bad guys can target to get into their company. So they've increased the number of vulnerabilities, but they've not addressed understanding the threat or educating their workforce. So this is a huge problem. And I recommend if you're a small to medium business and you're not spending a lot on cybersecurity, you at least spend some time or something on some kind of education to help people understand how they're being targeted, how to protect themselves, and even how to protect themselves at home. Because if they protect themselves at home first, they are more likely to help protect your business at home because they'll understand those things they need to do to stay safe. A friend of mine who I interviewed in the second podcast, Scott Augenbaum, has coined this the people-centric framework, and I agree right with him on it. If you can use your employees as your first line of defense, then it makes it much harder for those bad guys to get into your network using cyber tradecraft, and you've lowered your risk overall. So that was one article I thought was interesting. The other one was a cybercrime article out of Miami, Florida, where a 16-year-old teen was accused of launching a cyber attack that helped shut down Miami-Dade's online classes for the first 3 days, which is fantastic if you're a school and you've been out of school for several months because of COVID, and now you're trying to get back online with some kind of hybrid model. You've got students coming in, then you got students working taking class from home, and all of a sudden your online stuff doesn't work. The ironic thing, and I don't want to say ironic, but the thing I thought found interesting about this particular attack was he used a very old, very low-tech tool called the low-orbit ion cannon, which is a fancy name for a denial-of-service tool, which he could very easily find online for a couple bucks or maybe even for free. He doesn't have to have a lot of technical experience to use it, and it launched a denial-of-service attack against the school, which made their online resources inoperable. And because he was arrested within 3 days of this going on, it indicates he had very poor operational security, was not the brightest of criminals, but it goes to show the larger problem that schools specifically are going to face as this year comes to fruition, and they are doing a lot of their school remotely. That means that schools, much like the small and medium businesses, need to spend the money to increase their security capability, not just technically with firewalls and VPNs and things like that, but they need to educate their personnel and their students now as to what the cybersecurity threats are and how to lower their risk. So it's an interesting article. I think we're going to see a lot more of this going forward simply because technology evolves, or rather crime evolves with technology. As we discover new and better ways to use technology to help our lives, the bad guys are right there figuring out, how can I use this technology to cause havoc, to make money? In this case, probably the kid didn't want to do online school. I'm guessing as to his motivations, because I don't know them, but that this is kind of what he did. Was there a lot of loss to the school? It's probably minimal, but it could be a much larger problem if his actions are mimicked and copied elsewhere. So those are a couple interesting news articles, I thought. So keep those in mind as you go forward the week, as you're thinking about how to protect your own businesses or yourself and looking at the devices you have and keeping them safe. And with that, let's go talk to my guest. My guest is Senior Investigator for the Major Crimes Unit of the New York State Police Troop B, Ted Leveson. And for full disclosure, Ted and I are cousins who grew up together in Norwood. Ted, thanks for sitting in for this discussion.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So first off, did you ever think that 40 years ago, when I was babysitting you and your siblings every Monday night, we'd end up in law enforcement discussing cybercrime?
Never, no.
I think the closest we had to anything cyber-related was the Atari 2600 at your house that you would go to bed and I'd sit there and play basketball every night.
That's about it.
So how did you get into your current position as senior investigator for Troop B? What led you up to that? You've been a state trooper for 24 years, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Just give us a little insight into how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I joined the state police on October 28th, 1996. And everyone who joins up all starts from square one, which is going to the New York State Police Academy in Albany, New York. And that's a six-month-long academy. And after that, everyone becomes a uniform trooper. So I actually started out my career. I did a three-month training FTO program, which is a field training officer program, which is just kind of learning how things work on the road in the real-life environment. And after that, my training was complete. And then my first assignment was actually in Dutchess County, New York, in the Rhinebeck, Poughkeepsie area. And I worked there for a year and just did normal trooper stuff, which consists of traffic patrol, writing people tickets. And in New York, we also investigate crimes, too, as troopers. The state police was kind of created in New York because the need was recognized to have a rural police force in addition to the sheriff's department. So we were created, and that's basically what we do. We do a little bit of everything. We do criminal work, traffic safety, and we have many special details like aviation, scuba, special operations unit, just about everything you can think of. But anyway, I was a trooper for about 8 years. I was in Dutchess County for about a year, and then I moved back home to St. Lawrence County. And I worked there for the next 7 years or so as a trooper. And I was promoted to investigator in 2004. And they sent me directly to the casino detail, which focused on, you guessed it, casino crimes and some of the higher level crimes, money laundering and stuff like that. I did that for about 2 years, and then I went to another specialty unit, the gun investigation unit, which works hand-in-hand with the narcotics unit. We did a lot of undercover stuff, and we focused on drug and gun crimes. After that, I went to a lateral transfer still as an investigator to what they we refer to it as a back room unit. And that's just your regular investigator, criminal investigator unit. And we investigated every pretty much felony level crime from burglary, which would be, you know, someone reporting their lawnmower stolen from their shed, all the way up to sex crimes. We would do some computer crimes, a little bit of cyber crimes, and you really do a little bit of everything. And from there, I found my way to the major crimes unit, where we focus on your violent crimes, homicides, and things of that nature. I was then promoted to supervisor in 2016, and now I've been back to the major crimes unit as a supervisor now for about a year.
So in New York, so just to reiterate one major point you made, because a lot of people who listen, especially like my friends in Alabama, state troopers there they just do traffic patrol. So here it's a little New York, it's a little different. How many different jurisdictions are the troopers responsible for in the entire state?
I think there's about 10 or so. So we have I'm in what's called Troop B, and that consists of 5 counties. So if you were to look at a map of New York State, go all the way to the very top as far as you can go, and it would be those top 5 counties.
So from Messina across to Plattsburgh and down to Watertown?
Not quite. It would be to the county line, so it would be just north of Watertown where St. Lawrence County changes over to Jefferson County, and that Watertown is located in Jefferson County. So it's basically St. Lawrence, Franklin, Clinton, Essex and Hamilton counties.
And then to make the point of upstate New York, because when I know growing up, when I would say I was from upstate New York, I would always go, oh, you're from Buffalo.
Right.
Buffalo's not upstate New York. We are at the very top of New York. And I think, as I probably mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, not the end of the world, but you can see it from there.
Yeah. You can't get any far, any more upstate than we are.
Like. Right. Right. If you go any further upstate, you're in Canada.
That's right. I tell people I work in basically Southern Canada. So,
and how many people? So in that 5-county region, how many people are we talking about total?
So people that we serve, that's a good question. I believe St. Lawrence County has around 100,000. I would guess Clinton is a little bit more. So if I had to guess, I'd say maybe 300,000-400,000 people.
But the largest metropolitan area is Plattsburgh.
Yes.
Yeah. And to be honest, if you've not been to upstate New York, Plattsburgh is not exactly a thriving metropolis.
No. If you were to compare that to a normal city like, you know, where you're from, Huntsville or something like that, yeah, it's not even close.
Right. And on the other side of Plattsburgh is Burlington, Vermont, which is
just across state capital. The river,
But we're getting into more of a geography conversation, which I don't think anybody tuned in for. So we'll stop that. So how is cybercrime addressed here? So you have the state troopers who deal in all crimes, obviously. Then you have the sheriff's department. So every county has its own sheriff's department, but then every municipality has some kind of smaller police force. Like I know Norwood has a Norwood police force. I know growing up there was like one part-time police officer. I think they're up to 2 now, maybe full-time or something along those lines. So how is cybercrime – who addresses cybercrime? So if I was to have – the major cybercrime I think you would deal with up here, correct me if I'm wrong, are going to be crimes against children is probably the top priority. Is that correct? Online child exploitation?
Oh, yeah. As far as cybercrimes go, absolutely.
Yeah. And then probably fraud and –
Yep, and then you're kind of going on dollar amounts. I mean, you're going to start off with crimes against people, which are the most important, and then it's going to go down to property crimes from there. So it's a matter of how much money are you out.
Gotcha. So what are the major cybercrime issues here? So let's step back. So you were mentioning last night you have a cybercrime unit in Troop B, correct, or something along those lines?
Yes, we call them the computer crimes unit.
Okay, so. And what do they deal? What's their prime?
Yeah, so in my area, Troop B, I think we have about 4 or 5 guys, and that's it. And they are responsible. They work hand-in-hand with ICAC, which would be Internet Crimes Against Children, and they also work hand-in-hand with NCMEC, National
Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Thank you very much. And then in their spare time, they're doing cyber crimes, regular computer crimes. A lot of the time, they are an assisting unit. So when a cybercrime happens, the person may call 911. The first law enforcement person that they're going to interact with is going to be a road trooper. and he's going to show up and take the initial complaint. And then from there, depending on how serious it is, he'll bump it up to one of those backroom investigator guys. And they'll decide what to do. And if they decide they need more specific, I guess better training and people that have more training and that have more tools, then they're going to call on the computer crimes unit to help them out. And they do have some, specialized tools, and they definitely have a lot of training. They go all over the country, and they're very high trained. And because of that, they have to give a commitment if you were to get promoted into that unit. Because the state invests so much money into these guys, they have to agree to stay for a certain amount of time.
And do they come in with a cyber background, or are they more like, hey, I want to do that cyber stuff, so let me go do that?
A little bit of both. They have to pass an oral board to just get into the unit. And a big thing that our guys that we screen for is mental health, actually, because dealing with crimes against children, it can really weigh down on a person, and you have to make sure that you have the coping skills to deal with that. And then you got to have the technical skills too. So they look at the entire package. Some people will go to training with zero, computer background, and they'll train them up, and from there, they'll just work their way up the ladder.
And are the troopers the main, have the main jurisdiction over cybercrime? So if I was to become a victim of a cybercrime in Norwood, would be the troopers I would call, or would I call the Norwood Police Department, would I call St. Lawrence County Sheriff's deputies?
Yeah, it's kind of luck of the draw here. You will call, let's say if you call 911, you'll have a dispatcher, and it's kind of luck of the draw between the Sheriff's Department or the troopers, or if you find yourself in a jurisdiction that has a local police department, they will filter the call to them. Usually the Sheriff's Department and us, we handle every other area that's not covered by a local PD or a city police department. So it's kind of luck of the draw, really, unless you make a specific request for the troopers.
And so working cybercrime for the FBI, we always, because most of the crime we dealt with crossed jurisdictions, crossed state lines, or crossed international lines, we had to deal with those issues. How do you guys deal with that? Because if I call you and say I have a I got defrauded on eBay because I paid $10,000 for a boat and they never delivered the boat, but yeah, it turns out that I was buying the boat from California. How do you guys deal with that?
Yeah, because that's every single case we get. I mean, cyber crimes can reach out and touch anybody, anywhere. And yeah, we rarely ever see someone who is a victim of a cyber crime where the perpetrator is in our jurisdiction. It almost never happens. So the way we do it is, we'll try to track the person down, and there's some different ways we do that. And once we track them down, we have to now talk about how much is it going to cost us to get this guy back here. If it's someone in the country, we will speak with the district attorney, and he's the one that would ultimately have to pay for us to go find this person, arrest him, and then transport him back to our jurisdiction. And those guys look at a bunch of different factors, really. I mean, what's the severity of the crime compared to how much is it going to cost to get us here?
Do you have the legal means to do search warrants and subpoenas, electronic search warrants and subpoenas? Like if you can identify that the IP address belongs to an IP internet service provider in Texas, how do you serve that legal process to get more information on who that belongs to?
So, yeah, we do fall under federal guidelines in that part where these internet service providers are required, and I can't think of the statute, but there's a federal statute that says they do have to honor our search warrant, even though it's an out-of-state search warrant.
Oh, good. So you don't have to worry about going to, I got to go get an FBI partner to come help me get the legal process.
No.
That's good. At least the politicians have figured out a way around that. I know 20 years ago that was certainly a problem. We got a lot of calls from local police departments, hey, I can't go any further with this. Can you help me out? So,
and we get a lot of that ourselves, actually, because we'll get the guy from the local police department, and sometimes they don't have the resources to really go, and they may not have a lot of the training and stuff, and they'll come to us kind of the same way. Hey, we've got this case. This guy's out of our jurisdiction. Can you take it from here?
So how often do you guys bring in federal law enforcement, like the FBI, DHS, or Secret Service? Because obviously this is a very remote area where there is not a local FBI office nearby. The closest one is a resident agency in Syracuse. It's out of the Albany division. So how often do those interactions take place? And how often would they get in, are they willing to get involved?
So in my experience, we have worked with the FBI and some other federal agencies on occasion. It's usually when we have crimes against people, crimes against children, child exploitation and stuff like that, which we do have a very active assistant USA attorney, and the FBI is very active in that. When you go down to people who are defrauded out of money, they usually have a cutoff where they will help us out. It's usually somewhere around $50,000. So if the person is out anything below that, it's going to be handled by whatever agency is handling your case, and it won't be a federal agency. And then if you go above the $50,000, it's not cut and dry, but you have a lot better chance of getting someone from the FBI to help out. And so, yeah, that's we try to bring you guys down every chance we get.
Sure. And do you ever have contact with DHS or Secret Service? Because Secret Service usually does a lot of, from a cyber perspective, they're more focused on credit card related crime and financial fraud of that nature. But I'm going to guess that they don't have as large a presence.
Yeah. So very rarely do we work with the Secret Service in person. Usually when we do, it's with counterfeit bills. Mm-hmm. And so we will seize the bills and we ship them to the Secret Service. And from there, I think they document them and they probably have some kind of database that they enter them in. And that's usually our dealings with them. Department of Homeland Security, we do have a local office very close by. And their cyber unit is very helpful, really. They may not take the case and they may not prosecute it, but they're always more than willing to give us their expertise and tools on really any case we ask them for. They're always willing to help, which is great.
So you mentioned that child exploitation, crimes against children online, I'm sure is probably the largest, your number one priority up here. How prevalent is it? And are there any commonalities you see amongst the victims when you talk to the parents or the victims that you recover? What are some of those commonalities you see? Is there commonalities, or are they all kind of unique?
So it's very prevalent in this area, a lot more than I ever thought it would be. So the people who it affects, it's usually your children who are able to play on their iPad or their computer and not have any restrictions, have a Wi-Fi source that's readily available, and not a lot of parental interaction. And it's just, you know, these kids are able to go off, make their own profiles on social media and whatever it may be. A lot of times the parents don't even know they even have a profile on there. And I'm not saying they're bad parents either, but it's just parents that don't know, that mm-hmm. don't know what their kids are up to.
And don't necessarily want to know, really.
A lot of them don't want to know and don't, yeah, unfortunately, they don't care. A lot of them are really good parents and they may not be that tech savvy and they just kind of let their kids, the way they look at it is playing on an iPad can't really hurt you. But I think you probably know a lot different.
Yeah, sure. Have you seen any of that targeting through video games? There's a lot of the way that child exploitation has evolved over time. It's whatever technology is available to be able to exploit it for the bad guy. So now you have video games, you have the Xbox, PlayStation, and you have all of these apps that are very social media friendly, like TikTok, YouTube, all of those things. Do you see those particular areas as entry points for child predators to find their victims?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Definitely Microsoft Online with Xbox, and they're all the same now. You can wear a headset and you can play your game with and talk to other people, and you really have no idea who these people are. And we have had quite a few cases that way where we've had people try to exploit children as, you know, a way to open the door through that. We've also had some other great cases where someone made a suicidal comment playing an Xbox game, and the kid that they were playing with called the police. And they said, listen, I don't know who this kid is, but this is his screen name is, you know, whatever. And he just told me that he wanted to kill himself. And we're able to track those people down and have someone knocking on their door a lot of times within the hour.
That's great.
Yeah.
So let's move to – here's an interesting thing I think is probably – maybe is an issue, maybe it's not. But kids using online resources like to target schools as far as with all the social unrest we're seeing now? Have you seen any movement towards individuals saying, I'm going to go shoot up a school, I'm going to go do this at the school because I've been bullied? Obviously, I'm sure cyberbullying is a large issue that probably falls within your personal personal crime perspective. But
we do. We see it all the time. So, someone will make a comment on Snapchat. That seems to be a really popular one. I don't see a lot of younger kids really on Facebook as much, but they certainly are. So, but we do see a lot of it. Yeah, someone will make a thread on Snapchat or whatever that, yeah, whatever. I'm being bullied and I'm going to strike back tomorrow, or I'm going to shoot up the school. And it's the same thing. Someone will see it. They'll call us. And yep, if they know who the person is, that's great. Sometimes they don't know, and then we have to track them down through other means.
And my guess, again, is the parents were unaware this was occurring, correct? I'm going to guess that's a recurring theme.
Yeah, because I don't think you ever made a threat to blow up the school, and I never did.
Not that I can recall. but back then, I didn't have a – I would have had to write it on a billboard and paste it on the front of my – the front of the house or something.
Yeah.
So have you seen any municipalities or companies hit with some of the more business-oriented – targeting, like with ransomware, business email compromise?
We actually had a police department in the Albany region that was hit with ransomware. And I want to say the ransom was like $5 million. And they refused to pay it, but it spent them, or I'm sorry, it cost them almost as much money to fix it on their own.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And that was the police department that I got.
And my guess is they didn't have backups, so they couldn't refresh their system.
Yeah, I don't know the details of it, but I just know that was the story where they did have to shell out a ton of money to fix it.
And you know, here's an interesting question. Did they fix the problem that caused it in the first place so they don't get hit with ransomware again?
That I don't know. I hope they did. I don't know for sure. I can tell you my agency – is we have firewall upon firewall and backups upon backups, and we're very careful about it, but we're still not.
But that brings me to an interesting question. That's a good point you make, that of as far as you have backups and backups and all this technology. And what I've been preaching for a while is we're not going to use technology to solve this problem, because all the technology in the world is great. The problem with firewalls is if I am a Russian hacker and I've found a flaw in Windows 10 that no one has ever discovered, I can create ransomware on that, and your firewall is not going to block it because it doesn't know what to look for. Mm-hmm. So is there – let's just use your agency as an example. Do you guys have cyber education that talks about here's what the threats are, here's changes and vulnerabilities, here's things to be aware of, and don't click on – the big thing is don't click on links and emails and don't open attachments you're not supposed to. What's the training for you guys specifically look like, and – if you can, what is it like here regionally? Is there a lot of cyber education, or is it just kind of – if you get hit, you worry about it. If not, you're blind to it.
Yeah, so I think regionally there's very little cyber education. In my department, we – about once a year, we will take – it's actually online training. So it's online cybersecurity training, and that consists of about an hour of watching a few videos on scenarios and then maybe answering two or three questions on each scenario. And, you know, you've got social engineering and shoulder surfing and all those kinds of things. And don't leave your workstation unattended. So we do get training about once a year on that kind of stuff.
And do you really have to watch the video, or can you start the video, walk away, go do other stuff, and come back when it's done and you can move on to the questions?
Yeah, I would never do it, but I understand you can click right.
Oh, yeah, me either. Trust me. I watch every second of every video to train myself to make sure I know what the threats are. But
Yeah. I know. It's unfortunate. And
so let's move back to the ransomware that hit your Albany division. Do they know how it started? Do they know what caused it? Was it someone opening an email or clicking on a link?
And once again, I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but just based on other people talking about the incident, that's what I believe it was someone clicking on a link. They thought it was originated from within the department, and it looked like a legit email. And
right. Yeah. That sounds about right. That's exactly the case. So I'm honestly surprised that there's not more regional municipalities up here that have got hit with this, simply because I have to believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the budgets don't exist for the right hardware to protect it, or the education to make people aware of it, because it's just it is what it is.
Yeah, really, it's about money. And we're lucky to have four or five guys that are
sure.
Dedicated to do it. A lot of these other places don't have anyone. They've got their, their resident, quote-unquote, computer guy who has a little more experience than the rest of them, but he really hasn't been to any formal training, and he just happens to be naturally good at a few things. But, you know, that's not going to be good enough a lot of times.
Right. And so, and I would think that up here, the biggest issue is all of the, for the majority, not it's going to be all of them, but a lot of the political actors, the mayors and the county commissioners, that's not in a lot of cases their full-time job, is it? That's kind of they're volunteered to do that. I know in Norwood, obviously, you can speak to this because your uncle is the mayor of Norwood. Is that his full-time job? Is mayor his full-time job, or is he just?
No, I don't even know what it pays. It can't be very much, but I don't think any of the politicians around here do it as a full-time job.
Right. So how can you expect to have adequate cybersecurity in place to protect your resources if you're not even paying the people running the place?
Correct. That's right.
And then I'm not saying this is specific to upstate New York. This is specific to rural America. Mm-hmm. So the point of this podcast today is to talk about what rural America looks like, because we are more the rule than the exception. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more parts of America that are rural than are urban.
True.
So this is not just a problem here. This is a problem everywhere. So
I think rural America and a lot of agencies are similar in the fact that it's not a problem until it becomes your problem.
Right.
And I don't want to. I've seen it in my agency. We're not always like that, but I have seen it in my agency. But I definitely see it in rural America. People, like, one analogy is, up where we live, they leave their car doors unlocked at night. A lot of times they leave their house unlocked when they leave. And they're leaving their property unprotected. Anyone can go in there and steal it. And they treat their cybersecurity the same exact way. They go online and they leave the door open for anyone to come in and take whatever they want. And a lot of times they're more than happy to give it to them. And some of it is not being educated, and some of it is rural America. Maybe you're a little bit complacent that it hasn't happened here. And, in major crimes, I hear it on almost every case. That type of thing doesn't happen here.
Right.
But it does.
And I would think also with companies, so if you think about companies, because companies have a lot of resources, I would guess that the majority of them would tell you, if you were to go talk to them about how is your cybersecurity, my guess is the answer is, we don't have anything anyone would want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think people undervalue information, like people's personal information, how valuable it really is.
And that's a great point. And, it's one of these things where I'm going to guess in looking at the newspapers while I've been up here, the newspapers are pretty static and focused on, major issues that are here. But I haven't seen a lot of reporting on cyber issues other than I saw a thing today about COVID scams online with people getting Facebook notifications that, hey, you may be eligible for this grant, but you have to send me $39.95 to find out how to do that. So if you tell your cyber guys, if they haven't seen that yet, it's coming their way.
Yeah, I'll talk to them for sure. Yeah.
So if I made you cyber educator for the day for this area to go speak to Pillows, what would be the two things you'd want people to understand about not just cyber crime, but just crime in general up here and how to protect themselves?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that, yes, that kind of thing does happen here, and it can happen here. And so don't be complacent. And, the second thing is you have to be vigilant. And I think when most rural people go to the city, they've got their guard up a little bit more because they're like, okay, we're in the city. Things can happen here. Crime can happen here. And they've got their guard up and they have a little bit more situational awareness. So I guess I would ask, just realize that it can happen to you. And secondly, have some situational awareness on when you're online, who are you talking to and what information are you giving out to people? So I guess I've kind of been right. Two things.
And I'll end with this. You're probably the only person I will ever interview for this podcast who's known me since I was a teenager. So any humorous stories you want to tell the world about that about growing up in Norwood?
Oh, boy. I hate to say it. You were a pretty good kid, so the biggest thing that sticks out is peanut butter sandwiches and chocolate milk. That's all Darren ever wanted was if you gave him a peanut butter sandwich and chocolate milk, he was happy.
And so. Do you remember what I would call your mother? My
Aunt
nickname,
Bingy?
Aunt Bingy. Yes, correct.
Yep.
All right. Well, Ted, I appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, the issues that Ted and I discussed are not really just a rural problem. It's not just an urban problem. It's an everybody problem. Whether you live in a rural area or you live in an urban area or you live somewhere in between, which is not quite rural and not quite urban, those more in-between areas of the country still have the same limited law enforcement resources issue that rural America has, which makes it very hard for victims of cybercrime to achieve the justice they need or to try to get their money back or what have you. So how do you as an individual or how do you as a small business owner in some of these areas protect yourself and make sure you are not a victim? It starts off with education. If you do not understand or your employees do not understand the threats that are targeting you and the vulnerabilities they are using to get into your networks, steal your data, provide emails to your employees that result in business email compromise. Ted talked about a case after we got done recording of a company in Potsdam, New York, which is the small town next to Norwood, where the secretary of the small company got an email from who she thought was her boss saying that he was buying a car and he needed her to wire transfer $20,000 out of the corporate account to a wire address so he could buy the car. So she did it because it came from an email that appeared to be from her boss. Turns out it was not. And so they were out $20,000 because it went to a cyber scammer who was able to make her believe that the email she got was from her boss. So it's things like that that really have a huge impact on small businesses, small rural suburban areas of the country where who do you call? You can call the state troopers. You can call the sheriff's department. You can call the FBI. A lot of cases, even the FBI is not going to get your money back and probably not going to bring anyone to jail. Successes do occur. Don't get me wrong there, but that's more of the exception than the rule. So how do you deal with this? You have to educate yourself. So if you educate yourself, then that does definitely lower your overall cyber risk. The problem you probably are asking me, well, Darren, how do I get this information? Which made me think after I did this interview with Ted, how can I help individuals? How can I help businesses even more than I did previously with the FBI and getting this information. So I have a lot of resources I'm happy to provide anyone interested in it. You just have to contact me. There's a couple of ways you can reach out to me. You can email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at the Cyber Guy. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R, cyberguy.com. Or you can hit me up on LinkedIn. Just look for Darren Mott, D-A-R-R-E-N-M-O-T-T. I think I'm the only one, and it says Cyber Guy on my LinkedIn page, so I'm easy to find. But feel free to reach out to me. I can point you to some free resources. Check out InfraGuard, which is an FBI sharing organization. It's a nonprofit. It's not run by the FBI per se, but it's kind of managed by them. But there are a lot of companies that belong to that, and they have a lot of good information that they provide to InfraGuard members at no cost. Definitely start there. Go to ic3.gov. There's information provided there. I can provide some other resources as well. I can answer any questions that you might have that it's hard to find elsewhere, or at least point you in the right direction. And at some point in the near future, I hope to have online webinar or informational meetings that I'll create and make available to folks who are interested in it or who want to pass it to their employees if they so desire to do so. So look for that coming up in the future. Feel free to contact me again if you have any of those questions or if you'd like a question answered on a future podcast, feel free to email me or hit me up on LinkedIn. And I'll include those questions in a future podcast. Tell your friends how to get a hold of this podcast if you think it would be of interest to them or be valuable to helping them not become a cyber victim in the future. I appreciate everybody for taking the time to listen, and we will talk to you next week. Thank you very much.